stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. If you enjoy the show and would like to become a sponsor, please head on over to our Patreon page. For as little as $1 a month, you can help out and receive a Fisheries Podcast sticker in the mail. We've recently added levels where you can get free Fisheries Podcast merch as well. If monthly giving isn't your thing, check out our Teespring store for t-shirts, sweatshirts, and stickers. I'm happy to bring back Lang Solberg to the show to talk about his 2020 Alaska salmon fishing season. Lang was on episode 69 when we discussed a wide variety of topics, but I wanted to invite him back to share a little bit about some of the great things and some of the challenges of being a commercial fishing captain in the time of COVID. So just as a little reminder, Lang Solberg is an entrepreneur, writer, consultant, and fisherman. He completed his master's degree in marine affairs at the School of Marine and Environmental Affairs at the University of Washington. He's also a commercial salmon captain in the Bristol Bay sockeye salmon fishery and manages the North American business development for Real-Time Data's Deckhand electronic logbook platform. Welcome back to the podcast, Lang.
Hey, thank you. Nice to be on.
I'm super excited to talk to you some more about your fishing season. I had so many questions that we just couldn't get around to, and then you went fishing, so I'm excited to sort of hear more about how it went this year. The last time you were on, we talked about all kinds of different issues in fisheries, but today I wanted to focus a little more on your experiences as a commercial fishing captain. From our conversations before, I found the Bristol Bay salmon fishery really interesting, and I'd love to learn more about it from your perspective. So you fished this summer. How long were you in Alaska for?
I was in Alaska from about June 18th to, I think, the 26th of July. I tried to postpone my trip up to Alaska as much as possible. I knew I didn't have a lot of boat work to do, pre-season boat work and that sort of thing. And because of COVID and everything going on, I wanted to spend as little time out in the community as possible and kind of fly in and get the boat in the water, go fishing and fly home, just to decrease any, you know, exposure and that sort of thing while on the beach. So it turned out to be just over a month, and we got in, we did business, and we got out.
Can you remind us about your fishing vessel?
Yeah, so my fishing vessel is 32 feet long. In the Bristol Bay sockeye salmon fishery, the length limit is 32 feet, and it's been like that for decades. So the unique thing about these 32-footers in Bristol Bay is that they typically are wider than a normal 32-footer would be, just so that we can maximize deck space and carrying capacity and those sorts of things on the 32-foot platform that we're limited to. So I have a 32-footer. It's 15 feet wide. It's an aluminum gill netter. And we have a nice cabin and living quarters and almost a walk-in engine room and a full head, which is pretty nice for a boat of that size. And then we have a really good back deck working space and lots of machinery and horsepower and hydraulics and all those things that inevitably end up on commercial fishing vessels.
I think from my usual experience on the Gulf of Mexico, when I saw a picture of your boat, I was struck by how deep the draft was for that that size of a vessel. It seemed really deep to me. Use a lot of like really flat, you know, flat stuff.
Yeah, I mean, actually, my boat is probably a little bit deeper than some because it's a propeller driven boat and has protective shielding underneath the prop. But the advantageous vessel design for that fishery is actually a lot like you're talking about. Super shallow draft, a lot of flat bottom hull designs, because a lot of folks use jet boats in mm-hmm. Bristol Bay, since we're really just fishing on a giant, giant river delta up there with all of these big drainages emptying into, you know, the upper reaches of the Bering Sea. It's shallow really throughout Bristol Bay. We're operating in terminal harvest areas with a fisher about to kind of take their final turn and head up river to spawn and there's just not a lot of water to work with in a lot of the bay.
You said there's been a 32-foot length limit for decades. Was it in an effort to limit the fishery in some way, limit the total capacity or catch, or?
Yeah, it's funny. There's actually some debate out there as to what the origins exactly are for the 32-foot limit. The limit originates, and I'll probably get this wrong, but I believe it originated before statehood. Again, I could be wrong about that, but it's at least in the 50s, I think, that limit was codified. And I think most simple explanation was it was probably created back then just to keep an even playing field across the entire fishery. So there wasn't a race for a bigger, better, more powerful vessel among fishermen. And I would argue that, you know, that purpose for that regulation holds some water today, even although that, you know, if you look at 32 footers up there, they are some of the beefiest, craziest, most expensive, biggest 32 footers that you'll ever see anywhere else in the world. But I feel like that's going to happen with any sort of vessel limit.
What can you get away with based on the platform that's available?
Yeah, exactly. We have Board of Fisheries meetings every 3 years. The Board of Fish is a state of Alaska governor-appointed board that vets and passes or doesn't pass new regulations for the fishery. And it never fails that every time a board cycle comes up every 3 years, somebody puts in a proposal to do away with the 32-foot limit. It hasn't passed, but I guarantee you in the next board cycle, there will be a proposal to do away with the limit. And
yeah, that would shake it up.
It would. It really would.
I know there's been a lot of concern about importing COVID to Alaskan communities, especially some of the more remote ones. What special precautions did you have to take going up to Alaska this year?
Several. The work and paperwork and crossing T's and dotting I's that skippers and boat owners had to do before this year's fishing season was unlike any other season that I can remember. And understandably so. These communities are only accessible by plane and boat with extremely limited medical infrastructure. Even flying sick patients into Anchorage only gets you so far because Anchorage has limited medical infrastructure when you look at, you know, the number of beds per capita, I guess. And so to prosecute a fishery anywhere in the state of Alaska was a monumental feat this summer. And I think we pulled it off pretty well. There were very few cases out in the watershed. It seemed like the fishery was pulled off. We got product landed, sent out to market, but the bar was really high in terms of precautions. So just for my crew and I, we had to sign a COVID-19 mandate acknowledgement and file it with the state of Alaska. We had to follow, I think it was called Mandate 17 as independent fishermen, which was a laundry list of guidelines and requirements. So we had to sign a form that acknowledged that we were going to adhere to the guidelines set forth on that mandate. I had to prepare travel declarations for travel through Alaska for each crew member and myself, basically authorizing us as essential workforce to transit through the Anchorage airport and connect out to the rural communities. I had to give each crew member a travel authorization letter saying that they're with a specific fishing vessel as part of the essential workforce, and I'm the captain, and here's the vessel's official number, et cetera. And then I had to sign that. This wasn't required for us as fishermen, but I asked my entire crew that they get tested within 72 hours of departing the airport for Alaska. Luckily, all of our tests came back negative, and that was just nice to have under our belt as further peace of mind before we traveled out into the community. And my pledge was, if anybody on my crew, including myself, if I tested positive, we weren't going fishing. I wasn't gonna take the crew nor myself into a community where risk was really high if we tested positive prior to leaving our hometowns. I had to make the crew answer screening questions upon arrival to the boat. So, you know, the typical COVID you know, screening questions, 5, 6, 7 questions. I can't remember how many exactly, but, you know, have you felt any symptoms within the last 72 hours? Have you exceeded a particular temperature threshold, et cetera? We took daily temperatures and verbally screened each other on the boat for 2 weeks under kind of like a 2 week on vessel quarantine mandate. And the clock started again for those 2 weeks each time a new crew member arrived. We didn't all fly in together. So I got there on the 18th with one crew member. We had one show up on the 24th, I think, and the last one show up on the 26th. The clock started over on the 2 week quarantine each time somebody showed up, and we documented everything and logged everything twice a day. We quarantined to the boat for the entire season. So there was a 2 week quarantine mandate, but we just stayed on the boat for, I think, 30 or 31 days straight, never got off. We couldn't go on board tenders when we delivered fish. So we'd pull up to a bigger boat called a tender that offloads our catch. And typically I would go on board and sign the fish ticket and that sort of thing, but we weren't even allowed on board tenders. We sanitized and cleaned the galley and living spaces much more often. We wore masks and buffs. I basically ended up with an entire notebook of COVID-related paperwork that I was just dying for someone to ask me for, because we'd gone through all this stress and preparation, and we're all super nervous about pulling it off even just to begin with. And a lot of the language surrounding these mandates and all of these paperwork requirements had to do with, hey, you need to present this to the state troopers or to the Coast Guard, or if somebody gets sick, you're going to need to present all this paperwork and stuff. And I just wish that somebody would have looked at it, because we worked so hard to, again, cross T's and dot I's. And at the end of the day, nobody ever looked at it. So
that sounds like my entire scientific life. please just look at all this work that I did, please.
Yeah. And even like when my one crew and I traveled together, you know, we were nervous to get off the plane in Anchorage, where we had to make our connecting flight, because we knew that there were going to be certain checkpoints and people asking us questions. And we had our, like, we were sitting on the ground just pulling up to the gate, and as we were getting off, we were getting all our paperwork out to like show them our papers and stuff. And like, nobody bothered us. Mm-hmm. Nobody bothered us in the entire airport. We just went and sat down and got some food and got on the next plane. It was eerily normal. I was okay with some of that. But then on the other hand, I was kind of bothered by it, because we were really hoping for some, I guess, proof that these sort of protocols were in fact being enforced. I think if we would have left security and Anchorage would have been our final destination, we would have had to go through a checkpoint and answer some questions. But connecting to another flight was just like normal. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I do. You know, honestly, I think that is one of the more just strange things about this entire time, especially throughout the U.S., is just that everything mostly seems so normal, but it's really on you individually to do your part, you know?
Yeah.
And even especially, I live in Florida. I mean, Florida as a state has done virtually nothing, but I personally haven't sat in a restaurant since March. And it sounds like in Alaska, you know, people really are taking it very seriously, which is fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, I think the seafood industry in particular took it very seriously, along with the state of Alaska. These fisheries out here are taking place in far, far stretches of the state with limited capacity. And you just, I think the processors, the fishermen, the workers, all stakeholders involved recognize that one, you know, slip up could cost an entire season for an entire sector of the industry, or even the industry as a whole. Yeah, there was no choice but to take it extremely seriously. And nobody looking at my paperwork is a small price to pay.
Right. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Get to my ego more than anything. Yeah. And make no mistake, there were outbreaks in some of the processing plants, and some issues definitely that cropped up in our fishery and in others around the state. But I think the industry did a pretty good job.
It must be a monumental task just having to house all the processors, and, you know, yeah. I'm sure that they're used to a particular lifestyle that wasn't available to them during the season.
Yeah, the processors had it really hard. I think, you know, you have to fly in thousands of workers from all over the world to process fish. And in April and May, we were reading about some of these horror stories out of meat processing plants in the Midwest. Right. And our processing situation isn't much different than those. And so the processors had to do a lot, spend a lot of money, install a lot of last minute infrastructure in their plants to make it so these working environments were safe. I know a lot of the processors did mostly voluntary, but they did it anyway, 2 week quarantines prior to travel for their workforces. So they would, they'd put people up in hotel blocks, you know, in Seattle or San Francisco or LA, hundreds of workers at a time in a hotel, and they'd feed them 3 square meals a day and give them books and video games and other forms of entertainment. And then only at the end of that 2 week period and a negative test would they then board their flight for Alaska. Even after some of those 2 week quarantines prior to travel and then arriving in Alaska and multiple test requirements for each individual worker when on site in Alaska, positives were still cropping up. And were some of them false? Perhaps. I know not all of them were. And it's just amazing, this virus and this whole situation. You can throw up every brick wall imaginable, and then you still have these handful of positive tests coming through that far down the line. It was really perplexing to me.
Viruses find a way, man. Yeah. They're crafty. Kind of back on board the boat, your usual crew complement. How many total fishers are on your vessel?
Including me, 4. Mm-hmm. And we go back and forth between 3 total and 4 total.
4 people staying on a 30-foot vessel for a month. That's tight.
Yeah, tight. Tight's a good way to describe it. Yeah, some boats are really tight. Others are not as tight. But yeah, 3 or 4 people on a 32-footer for a month is nothing to shake a stick at. The 2 of the crew members I have, one of them I grew up with, and the other is another really, really good friend. We did bring somebody new on this year, just because we knew, you know, we weren't getting off the boat. There wasn't going to be much downtime, and we wanted as many cards in our hand as possible to have a successful season. So we did bring a new person on, and he worked out well, and we all got along really well. A lot of good meals while on anchor and cribbage games, and, you know, we get through it.
So the food situation,
mm-hmm.
You weren't leaving the boat for a month.
Yeah.
How you didn't have to bring all your food, like ship it or anything, right?
We absolutely did.
You did. Okay.
Yeah. So every year around the March, April timeframe, we make the Costco run. And the Costco run is everything you could imagine it would be. We load up a big tote, all of the non-perishables and things that'll last us through the season. And that tote gets shipped by barge from Seattle to Bristol Bay for us, along, so the food, and then along with like parts and supplies, other supplies, and then all of our fishing gear that we work on throughout the winter, that all gets shipped too. So when we arrive, that stuff is there waiting for us, and then we load the boat with all of that stuff, or take the part that we knew we needed to ship up and install it or whatever. So, and then when it comes time to fly up, we'll maybe take a couple of ice chests along with us as checked luggage with like fruits and veggies and other things that we can't ship up as early as March or April. So typically pretty flush with food and eat pretty well. The things that we do need to supplement with while we're up there, we get through the fish processing company that kind of keeps us supplied with other incidentals while we're out on the fishing grounds.
Yeah, and of course you do have to bring all of your replacement parts and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's right. There are a couple of marine supply stores in the community out there, but they get completely thrashed by everybody. You know, the shelves are looking pretty bare by the time the fleet even just starts fishing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you need something that's any more unique, I guess, than your on the shelf product, you're probably going to be flying it from from Seattle or Anchorage or another hub.
So you said this is a gillnet fishery?
Yeah, it's entirely a gillnet fishery. Mm-hmm.
How much gillnet do you fish at one time in a commercial setting? Like, I've fished scientific gillnets, but they're probably pretty short compared to what you have.
We can fish with either one or two limited entry salmon permits on any given vessel. Depending on whether you're a single or a dual permit vessel, that dictates how much gear you can fish. Mm-hmm. So I'm a single permit. I can fish 150 fathoms in length of gillnet. So 900 feet of gillnet in length. The nets are 29 meshes deep by regulation, no more, no less. And so, yeah, 150 fathoms on a single permit of 29 mesh deep gear. Each mesh is anywhere between 4.5 and 5.5 inches in measurement. So a dual permit vessel can fish another 50 extra fathoms of gear in length. So it's not like they can fish double. But mm-hmm.
And this is strung, so this is basically a giant river delta, and is it strung sort of along longshore, sort of along the contours of the beach, or
the nets are set wherever a fisherman thinks the fish are, mostly
sure.
You know, like perpendicular hopefully to the way that the fish are running so that they'll hit the net. Mm-hmm. And that can be, yeah, I mean, it can be close in by the beach. It can be out in deeper water. The contour of the bottom, the bathymetry of the place is changing every year. I mean, with how strong the currents are up there and how large the tide swings are, things are always changing. When we do get ice in Bristol Bay in the wintertime, that of course changes things a bit too. And so you're always kind of working the different sandbars and contours of the bay. Sometimes the fish are on the beach, you know, in shallow water. Sometimes they're just not, and you have to go find them elsewhere. Sometimes they're running in this place at a certain stage of the tide one year, and another year they're just not, and they're over here at another stage of the tide. So it's challenging for sure. Always no shortage of a little bit of guesswork, a little bit of working with other boats in your group, and eventually, hopefully, finding the fish.
How long do you soak that gear for?
It can be, you know, an hour or two at the most, if you're kind of on a long, as the old saying goes, rum and coke and let her soak. when you're in heavy fishing and you're in traffic, you know, a lot of times you'll set the net and you'll pick up pretty quick after that, within 10 or 15 minutes.
I'm imagining that that's pretty dicey. Traffic and a bunch of gillnets hanging around.
Yeah, and then you throw in some district boundary lines with state troopers patrolling those boundary lines, and a little bit of you know, tide and current action in with that, and Mother Nature, you know, sending you across a boundary line or shooting you in toward the beach, traffic and all those sorts of things. It makes for some interesting towing that has to be done, and getting the net aboard as fast as possible, and it's packed with adrenaline.
I can see why people would use a jet boat now.
Yeah. Jet boats are pretty user-friendly when it comes to maneuvering fishing gear around. If I had to build a boat again, I'd probably build a twin jet boat.
Yeah. I have had to get some mono off of a prop before. It's not that fun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Webbing the wheel is no good.
Oh, no. I think we talked about this a little bit the last time, but can you tell me a little bit more about what happens to the fish once you get them on board the boat?
The fishery's come a long ways in the last, you know, 40 years or so in terms of fish quality. We take extremely good care of the fish when they come on board. We get paid more if we do take good care of the fish when they come on board, because better fish quality on the boat equals better fish quality in the seafood section at the grocery store. It's very direct. And in fact, I was in a Safeway a couple of days ago here locally looking at some previously frozen sockeye fillets. And I was a bit disheartened to see the fish quality that was on display in the case there. And so that can happen for a multitude of reasons, but in order to mitigate bruising, and gaping in the meat and all that. We reel the fish on board that are caught in the net. We carefully pick them out of the net. We don't shake them. We don't, you know, slam them or anything like that. We pick them out carefully. They slide down kind of a rubber trampoline looking fish slide that decreases in elevation as you move forward from where the net comes over the back of the boat. And as the fish slide down that, it ensures that they don't fall on the deck from the net. Rather, they slide down, they're kind of deposited gently up forward where our fish hold hatches are, and they slide into refrigerated 34 degree or 33 degree seawater that we're circulating through all of our fish holds. And that keeps the fish bright, the meat from getting soft, and keeps the fish from going into, you know, like rigor too quickly, mm-hmm. and all of that, just really maintains the freshness of the product. So, and we're also bleeding them when they're on board. And so that really helps on the bruising side of things down the track. And at the end of the day, we pull up to the tender and we pump down our chilled seawater and offload the fish onto the tender that has chilled seawater. And then the tender takes the fish from several of the smaller fishing boats and hauls bigger loads into the plant for processing.
So you get them out of the net. You said you bleed them before they go into the seawater. Do you gut them?
No. In some fisheries, like the Troll King Salmon fishery, Coho Salmon fishery in Southeast Alaska, they're gutting and freezing at sea. We don't have the capacity nor the infrastructure really, nor the desire by the processing companies, I guess, to buy gutted fish in such high volumes. We wouldn't even have the time to do that because the volume of fish pushing through the area is just so incredibly high. It's a matter of getting fish on board as fast as possible and getting them delivered as fast as possible.
The tender comes by once a day, or you have multiple rendezvous with the tender on it every day?
Yeah, the tenders usually anchor in convenient sort of central areas for us to drive to once the fishing period has closed or we're loaded up or whatever, and we offload kind of in central locations. We fish really based on the tides. So per Alaska Department of Fish and Game regulations, at least in our district, it's required that we open that the fishing period opens at a certain tide stage into the flood tide. So we can't fish, I think it's before 7 feet of flood tide has already occurred. And then we can fish between that point and I think it is again 7 feet before low tide. And of course there are two tide cycles every 24 hour period. So when things really get heated up, we're fishing both of those tide cycles. So Yeah, through the night, through the day, short naps and kind of resets in between.
Yeah, I was going to ask you multiple different things, but I think you clarified all of them. First of all, I just always chuckle. I'm pretty sure you told me about 7 feet of tide before. Yeah, our total here in Florida is like two. and so this is a semi-diurnal tide cycle. You have a full high and low about every 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a quick turnaround.
Yeah, and there is a lot of water that moves up in that part of the world. It's dangerous. It's amazing. It's the amount of life that moves in and out of the area with that amount of water is just astounding.
So the fishery, we talked the last time about how the fishery is managed basically in real time by the scientists watching the escapement up the rivers.
Right.
And I do hope to have one of those scientists on to explain to us the process a little more, because it's so amazing to me.
I hope so too, yeah. It's kind of like the craziest version of reality TV you've ever seen on each commercial fishing boat, because it's like, you know, you get the boat in the water, you go kind of do a shakedown cruise, make sure nothing breaks, and then you drop the anchor and you kind of wait. Hopefully the fish are starting to run by then and you can start fishing right away. But a lot of times it's just a matter of waiting and listening to the radio and listening to the biologists give you the daily update on what is taking place, both out in the salt water with some test fishing that's going on, as well as in the upper watersheds where the counting towers are and people are counting fish that are escaping to go spawn. And so,
and wait, is it common to wait several days before you can even start?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's common to wait several days before we can start. It's common to start fishing and then get shut down for a couple of days or several days. The run sometimes comes in fits and starts. Sometimes it's a nice even bell curve and it's just really workable and doesn't wear you out too quick. Other times nothing happens and then everything happens, and you know, 30 million fish come by in 4 days, and it's just gangbusters and the processors are plugged and you end up on limits and suspensions, which did happen to us this year. So you never know what you're going to get in terms of run timing and run volume and how, you know, how that is kind of deposited across the fishing season on a daily and tidal basis. So we're always just kind of on the edge of our seats waiting for the next bit of news and waiting for the next announcement coming from the biologists. It's like reality TV, but you're in the show and nothing about it is scripted.
That's wild to think about, that you could be waiting for ages and heavy or light or nothing, or
yeah.
And then the capacity of the people downstream from you and the processing and everything is going to limit what you can do. And
yep.
Everybody's really dependent on everyone else.
My dad always tells a story, and I think it's like in 1977 and 78, or it was 78 and 79. I can't exactly remember the 2 years, but one year, the first year of that 2 year period, there was one 12-hour fishing period for the entire season because the fish weren't showing up. And then I think the second year there was no fishing. Fishermen spent all this money and time and resources to prepare. Processors did the same. Everybody showed up. Not enough fish showed up to warrant a commercial fishery as per regulation. And when that happens, it happens. And that's the beauty of the model. You know, we're not going to exploit this fishery, you know, the future be damned.
I think that is key and so important for, you know, all of our natural resource management, no matter what it is. And also, you know, thinking about it, that's one of the things that I've always loved about being on a boat of any kind is, you know, in your situation, you're talking about a much larger ecosystem. But in a lot of cases, when you're on a boat, you are the only people really in the world. You know, your little community is really the only one that exists at that mm-hmm. moment, especially, you know, in a remote location or offshore far or something like that. Is, you know, the people who are immediately in your vicinity are the ones who have any impact on your life, and you impact them so substantially that it's just important to maintain that entire community.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, it's something I don't think about too often until I'm responsible for the three people in my little community on my fishing boat. And it takes me off guard a little bit how my mindset changes all of a sudden from the daily life when you're not fishing to being responsible for three people, maintaining a sustainable atmosphere and working environment on board. And also thinking about, you know, like in my shoes as the skipper, I'm thinking about their families, and I'm trying to make decisions that obviously are going to catch us fish, but it's about so much more than that. It's about, you know, man, I really hope we can reach this goal by this day, because I know that so-and-so has a new baby on the way, and I really want to be the best skipper I can to ensure that he makes some money to mm-hmm. take home for that situation. And you start thinking about, yeah, these people in your immediate vicinity on board and all they're doing for you to make the boat work, and all you need to try and do for them to send them home with something for their efforts. That
this is such a small example, but I am strict about water use in my house.
Yeah.
And it comes entirely from the fact that a lot of my offshore experience is on vessels that don't make water. The only water is the water that you have that you bring with you. Something that I wish everyone could experience.
Oh, the lessons learned there could have broad reaching positive impacts. If like, right. If everybody used water as if they had one 50 gallon tank of water, and no more in the world, we'd be in a better place for sure. It always really upset me when I'd watch my friends growing up leave the water running while they were brushing their teeth.
Yeah.
Because I grew up fishing with my dad and it's like, no, shut that off. Like you only need a few drops to clean those, you know, forks and knives and things. And still bothers me to this day.
In your mind, what do you think was the best thing about this season?
The best thing about this season was probably the fact that we experienced a huge return of sockeye salmon to the spawning grounds that far exceeded the forecast for the 2020 season. This has been happening the last few years in Bristol Bay. And in one sense, it's just fantastic. In another sense, it's kind of concerning because it's like, when is this train? It seems to keep speeding up as we go down the tracks. And when is it going to fall off the tracks or crash? And it's like, we've looked at other fisheries around the state of Alaska, other salmon fisheries in particular. And there isn't a lot of good news out there, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, but Bristol Bay has been producing. I think the forecast for the 2020 season was around 46 or 48 million. And we blew through that with a total run, I think approaching 60 million, maybe it was 57. These are fish that are wholly dependent on the ecosystem. They're not hatchery raised. There's no human interference with the life cycle of this salmon resource. They're genetically diverse. They're coming from all sorts of tributaries and river systems and lakes, and they're making their way to sea. They're spending, you know, 2, 3, 4 years at sea, and they're coming back, and they're just blowing our minds in terms of their volume. And I'm really thankful for that. I think that was the best part of the season, and I hope it continues, because in a world of a lot of negative news out there, this is definitely a very bright spot in terms of Mother Nature doing what she's supposed to. And I think that a lot of that is simply because we just don't touch it. Yeah, we harvest some of it, we take some of it, but otherwise we just stay hands off.
So among the many, many challenges of this season, what do you think was the biggest challenge?
I say the COVID paperwork was challenging, and staying on top of keeping a safe working environment in light of COVID was definitely a challenge, but I don't think it was the most challenging. The most challenging for me, I think, is just processing all of the uncertainty right now in the world and how that pertains to my little fishing operation in Bristol Bay. Global markets for seafood are going through things that are unprecedented. Some of the outcomes are positive for us, you know, some aren't. The, you know, climate change is surely a factor. We have other industrial development that continues to threaten the area and the region out in Western Alaska and Bristol Bay that we're always keeping our eye on, and a lot of groups are fighting tooth and nail. And just with all of the kind of big existential challenges, each one of them, I think altogether processing them and thinking about my fishing business and my family and other families and communities and people impacted by this fishery, trying to process how the future looks for that is the most challenging. And when you stack COVID on top of that, that was extremely challenging this particular season. What's this fishery going to look like next year, in 3 years, in 5 years? Should we sell out? Should we stay in for the long haul? You know, all these questions. And
Do you have some things you're looking forward to
in the fishery? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said earlier, these fish keep coming back. We're not messing with the resource much, you know, again, besides harvesting a portion of it. I think that gives me great hope for the future. Just watching how prolific the resource is now, I I don't believe there's any reason to be too concerned about the future. Now, fisheries do collapse. Weird things happen out in the ocean. We really don't know what goes on with these fish during their ocean life cycle in particular. But there's nothing acute or anything that, you know, that's giving me reason for concern for the future. So I look forward to a future of continued healthy returns and river systems and hopefully favorable ocean conditions for sockeye salmon. I look forward to seeing how our product, wild caught Bristol Bay sockeye, fares in the marketplace, especially given some of the supply chain implications and challenges due to COVID. I think we have a fantastic product that is logistically a lot easier to distribute, especially around the United States and Canada, than say farm salmon from Chile or Norway. We have a fleet-wide branding effort called Bristol Bay Sockeye, Alaska's sockeye salmon, that is seeing incredible results at retail with a lot of the retail partners we're working with across the country. So I just don't think there's anywhere but up for how people feel about Bristol Bay sockeye and how it is introduced to more and more people across the country as a really fine source of protein and nutrition.
Lang, thank you so much for coming back. It was a real pleasure chatting with you again. And if people want to connect with you online, where can they find you?
I am on Twitter at Lang Solberg, also on Instagram at Lang Solberg. I've got several fishing-centric photos on Instagram I've tried to throw up. And so if folks are interested in that, they can see some pictures of the fishing boat and our operation there.
Thank you so much for listening. I want to remind everyone that we do now have a Patreon page for the show, so if you feel inclined, head on over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast and check it out. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at fishvecchio. The podcast is Fisheries Pod. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I'm Julie Vecchio, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, eat Bristol Bay sockeye salmon.
Constantly on my 3-year-old about it. Shut that off. You don't need that much water.
Exactly. send him to sea.
Yeah, absolutely. He's, I'm ready right now.
You're going to sea, kid.
Go.